The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at home. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer, editor here in the Free Library's author events office, South Philly branch currently. Ezekiel J. Emanuel is Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. It's very hard to fit on a business card. An oncologist and author of 9 books on medical ethics and healthcare, he previously served as a special advisor for health policy in the Obama administration. Dr. Emanuel is also a special advisor to the Director General of the World Health Organization, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and was the founding chair of the Department of Bioethics at the National Institutes of Health. He is also the author of more than 200 scientific articles and writes for the New York Times, somehow in his spare time. His 9 books include Reinventing American Healthcare and a memoir about his relationship with his illustrious brothers, Rahm and Ari. Emanuel's new book is called Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? As I said, not an easy question to ask and a mammoth, complex question to answer. In it, he examines 11 disparate countries' healthcare systems and, spoiler alert everyone, shows how the U.S., despite spending far more than any other nation, doesn't even come close to having the best. Zeke, take it away. I'll rejoin you in a bit, and the stage, as it were, is yours.
Thank you. I have to say I'm somewhat conflicted in that I much prefer being live and being able to see the audience. I have to say that, there are 400 of you out there if the little tag at the bottom is correct, and that's larger than my several previous episodes and appearances at the Free Public Library. So you got to trade off things. I do wish I could be in person with you and also sign the books for you. I want to begin, for those of you who don't know me, by just observing that I'm a super competitive person. And I love to rank things. My kids, when we used to have dinner, would often goad me on about ranking, and they would come up with a name of a person who was in the news or some event and ask me, how would you rank that person on whatever scale they thought was appropriate or would be funny when I ranked them on the scale. Well, for the record, I do like to eat and I like to rank restaurants. I even rank a few in the book. I will just for the record say that my favorite Philly restaurant is Laurel. There are many, many great Philly restaurants. Philly is a fantastic food city, but Laurel takes at least my ranking. Now, for nearly a decade, I have resisted the project of trying to answer the question, which country has the world's best healthcare? Lots of people in audiences have asked me that question, and I have resisted. And not done it. Mainly, I've resisted because out there are 9 different rankings of healthcare systems around the world. The granddaddy of them all is the World Healthcare Organization's ranking from 2000. And they came to the conclusion that France was number 1, Italy was number 2. Well, let me just say there are 8 subsequent rankings. None of them have France or Italy as the top 2 countries. Typically, we get Norway and Switzerland up at the top, but in a Bloomberg ranking, Norway and Switzerland didn't make the top 10, and other Scandinavian countries and Germany also didn't make the top 10. So I've often concluded the previous rankings made no sense. Making a ranking was really a fool's errand. And then I found a great quote summarizing the situation. And I'll just read you the quote now. There is a significant relationship between a country's FIFA, that is their soccer ranking, and its WHO ranking. Taken at face value, the statistical analysis suggests that if a national football team or soccer team does well, the WHO score of that country increases. Well, if only that were true for the United States. But I finally convinced myself that it was probably a good idea to do rankings, not in the way that everyone else has done it. We did think, or I thought, that if I went around and found out what other countries were doing, what they were doing well, what they were doing poorly, how they were similar to the United States, how they weren't similar, we might not get a sort of alternative system that we could, as one author put it, lift and shift into the United States, but we might have suggestions about how to improve the U.S. healthcare system that would be useful going forward. So I found 10 countries, or picked 10 countries besides the United States. In the Pacific area, Australia, Taiwan, and China were selected. North America, we took Canada, often because Canada is a butt of a lot of commentary and we should get to the truth of it. In Europe, we took a Scandinavian country because a lot of progressives like everything Scandinavian, so we took Norway. Conservatives often tout Switzerland, so took Switzerland. Germany and the Netherlands have particular systems. France, as I mentioned, was number one. And of course, Britain often gets beat up as a socialist system, and we wanted to get to the bottom of how good or bad the Swiss system was. We then ranked them by 22 metrics. We did not do a numerical ranking because I think some of the things you care the most about really can't be reduced to numbers. For example, which country allows a wide choice of physicians and hospitals? Which country has limited waiting times? Which countries have good coverage of long-term care? Which countries have low drug prices? So some of those can be numeric, but a lot of them and a lot of the ones you care about aren't numeric. Well, spoiler alert, we came to five conclusions. As was just mentioned, no country performs tops on all of the metrics that we found. And in that regard, given that I'm a professor, we ranked that none of them got an A. Every country has some areas of challenge. Second, the United States is not in the top 10 of countries ranked in the world, and it doesn't perform particularly well overall. Third, the United States is not the worst, even among the 11 we selected. I reserve that for China for reasons we could discuss. I'll tell you, primarily, the Chinese have this hospital-centric system where they have almost no physician offices. The best physicians work in a hospital. They have three tiers of hospital, sort of a community hospital, a secondary hospital, and then the elite central hospitals like the Comprehensive Cancer Center in Beijing. And you might imagine, and doctors are affiliated with the hospital, and the best doctors are affiliated with the best hospitals. So if someone gets a serious illness, they go to a hospital. This is one reason in the midst of the COVID pandemic, the Chinese had to build additional hospitals because there were no physician offices to treat them, no ambulatory surgical centers or other centers where you could treat people, no urgent care centers. So you have to build hospitals to treat people. When the rest of the world is decreasing the number of the hospitals they have, the Chinese are still totally focused on hospitals, and that made them the worst, in my opinion. So the United States is not in the top 10. On the other hand, it's not the absolute worst. And there's a matter of fact, and this might surprise some of you listeners, there are things that the United States actually excels at. And one of those is innovation. We are the best in many regards at innovation, innovating how to pay doctors and hospitals. In the 1980s, we innovated how to pay hospitals, what's called DRGs, diagnostic related groups, instead of paying for each individual thing done in a hospital, the x-ray, the lab test, the room, and other checks. You pay hospitals one fee, and that fee covers a whole hospitalization, say for a heart attack. That model, the DRG model, was pioneered, as I said, in the United States in the 1980s and has since subsequently been adopted by almost every country, developed country, that is for paying hospitals. Similarly, today, the United States is actually innovating in payment. figuring out how to pay doctors differently, hospitals differently, trying to give what are called bundle payments or give capitation so that doctors get paid a set price to take care of the diabetic patient. And that provides an incentive for keeping the patient healthy so they don't go to the emergency room or the hospital and use a lot of resources that could have been avoided if they had not had problems with their blood sugars and been unhealthy. This kind of payment innovation is something the United States is leading the world in. And as a matter of fact, when we went to some of these countries and talked to health policy experts, they would often ask us about the payment innovation. How is it going? What's being learned? The United States also is innovative in delivering chronic care and delivering mental health care. Might surprise you. No country does well on mental health care, but the United States and the Netherlands actually stand out for trying to innovate around mental health care. In the Netherlands, primary care practices are actually the front line for treating mild mental health problems like situational depression or anxiety disorder. And as a consequence, over 80% of primary care practices actually have hired nurses to be specialists in providing mental health care. And the number of visits to primary care doctors to get mental health care has doubled across the country. Similarly, the United States has innovated, and many places have tried to actually have mental health providers work alongside of primary care doctors and specialists in the United States. This collaborative care model has been particularly useful. In addition, there are big healthcare systems that have set up special telemedicine for behavioral health, especially to deal with emergencies and for those patients who have mental health problems that prevent them from coming out of the house because they fear crowds in social settings. And we've seen a lot of integrating mental health routine screening and getting patients care in 24 or 48 hours if they screen positive for depression, anxiety, or other conditions, rather than the usual waiting several months to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. So the United States has been an innovator in the mental health field. Still, no country's performing well, but these are important experiments that we need to follow up on. The last thing I want to do is that there are several other issues that I would like, or lessons that we've learned by going through these countries that I'd like to consider. One is that a lot of people in the United States, and I suspect a lot of the listeners tonight, often frustrated with the United States. We don't have universal coverage. Even with the Affordable Care Act, we still seem to have 9, 10, 11% of the population does not have health insurance. And that seems like a terrible embarrassment. Guess what? It is a terrible embarrassment. But it's also important to recognize that universal coverage is something that has only recently come to a lot of developed countries. And this, I have to say, despite being a health policy expert working in this area for a long time, was new to me. The first country to really get universal healthcare coverage was actually Britain right after the war in 1946 when it instituted the National Healthcare Service. That was the first truly universal for the entire population healthcare coverage. No other country had done it for the entire population. Different countries, Germany, France, had done it for some segment of the population, but not for the entire population. And that, I think, does happen with Britain first. Germany, while it instituted health insurance beginning in the 1880s under Bismarck, actually did not get to universal healthcare coverage until 1972, when it finally included the self-employed and farmers in coverage. Canada, just to our country to the north, began in 1972 to have universal coverage, but it finally became truly universal in 1984 with enactment of the Canada Health Act. Australia got universal coverage in 1983, Switzerland had 80% coverage in 1960, but finally got to universal coverage in 1994 as a law, Taiwan in 1985, and France in 2000. Now, a lot of these countries, like the United States, had partial coverage of the population before, but definitely didn't have universal coverage until relatively recently. And I think that's a surprise for many people. It certainly was a surprise for me. Thus, the United States is definitely a laggard. Here we are, December 2019, before COVID hit, and we still had only gotten to 90% coverage. It's not because we can't, but we have been unable to pass the legislation necessary. More importantly, I would say for you, and I think, again, this may not be fully known to everyone, we have no path with the ACA of getting to universal coverage. It's not because the ACA didn't try to get to universal coverage. It's because the Supreme Court, in its decision in 2012, NFIB, actually, by allowing states to opt out of the expansion of Medicaid and made it impossible to get to universal coverage. We have 14 states representing a third of the population in the United States that have been utterly refused to expand Medicaid. And that means no matter what we do, we can't get to universal coverage if those states won't expand Medicaid. To me, one of the lessons of that is we're going to have to take Medicaid away from the states and bring it to the federal government if we truly want to get national universal coverage. I think the states, Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, they've been pretty implacable. And I don't think working and trying to persuade them or bribe them additionally is going to get us to universal coverage again. Another lesson that I learned by traveling to these countries is that there are common problems across all developed countries. High costs. Yes, it is true the United States spends more than other countries, but it turns out other countries, even if they spend 12% or 11% of their GDP on healthcare, are feeling the pressure of spending more and more money on healthcare and are worried about that spending. Part of that problem is the same problem that we're feeling. They feel like drug costs are too high. Every other country does a much better job of regulating drug prices than the United States, but they're all worried about high drug costs and how to manage high drug costs. So that is a particular problem. Again, it's not unique to the United States. It's faced by every other country, even countries that have a very good system for regulating drug prices. Every country is plagued by inefficient and unnecessary care. We may have more of it in the United States, spending hundreds of billions of dollars on inefficient and unnecessary care, but other countries are having just as much problem with inefficient and unnecessary care. For example, we were in Germany, and one of the complaints we heard of by health policy experts, the government, is they have too many hospitals. And one of the problems of having too many hospital beds is that they think they have a lot of excessive and unnecessary surgical procedures because the beds are empty and doctors operate. So there's also a problem, as I already mentioned, on mental health. No country has solved that problem. There's problems with chronic care coordination. So let me just remind you, 85 cents of every dollar we spend in the United States, we spend on patients who have chronic illness, heart disease, emphysema, diabetes, hypertension, asthma, cancer. It's not people who have acute problems, a broken hip, or lacerate their finger, or get into a car accident that really drive healthcare costs up and have us consuming resources. It's patients with chronic illness. And as I already mentioned, to actually bring healthcare costs down, to improve the quality of care, you have to focus on these people with chronic illness. You have to manage them better. You have to coordinate their care. That's not done best in a hospital because a chronic illness is something people have every day. And hospitals are about acute care, getting in there, fixing someone, and discharging them. So you need chronic care coordination. And again, this is one area that the United States stands out in, but no country has really solved this problem system-wide. Trying to get doctors to have someone who coordinates the care for patients, who calls the patients, works with them to help them manage their problems, and where patients identify problems early, come in, and the doctor is able to address them quickly before they become serious problems and require a hospitalization. Finally, every country we visited has a challenge related to long-term care. We're going to have a tsunami of seniors coming with multiple chronic illnesses, the high rates of Alzheimer's disease. We've seen how nursing homes are problematic for things like COVID. How are we going to handle this growing number of seniors? It's a problem all over the world. Now, 9 of the 11 countries we looked at, they were doing it what we were doing. They were holding together and paying for long-term care with baling wire, chewing gum, and all sorts of patchwork systems. Only two countries I visited, Netherlands and Germany, actually had secure mechanisms for financing long-term care. They have a payroll tax, which they add on to the payroll tax that finances the healthcare system, and that finances long-term care. That's a big advance that the other 9 countries did not have. In addition, I will say almost every country is trying to do what's called aging in place. Instead of putting older people into facilities like nursing homes, they're trying to have them live at home or live with relatives and support them financially for getting outside help. Or in Germany, they even pay relatives when they care for their older member of the family and help defray the costs associated with that. Nonetheless, long-term care remains a serious problem worldwide, and no one has fully licked it. So I'm going to end this part of the talk with a few ideas we've learned from visiting other countries that we might bring back to the United States. First, we can get to universal coverage. And I would say here or suggest here that the model we might want to use is the Netherlands and Germany. In the Netherlands and Germany, employers and employees pay a payroll tax and it goes to the government. Then they choose a private health insurance, what is called in Netherlands and Germany, a sickness fund. In Germany, they can choose from about 100 of them, in the Netherlands, about 22. The government then pays the sickness fund a premium, the insurance premium. They pay based upon age, sex, and the health status of the person, what's called risk adjusted. The individuals have to pay a small premium to the insurer. And then the insurer organizes care, pays the doctors, pays hospitals, and other things. This is a much more efficient system. They also actually regulate the prices paid to hospitals and doctors. This is a much more efficient system. And if adopted in the United States, we would be able to keep our private health insurance system, but have it much more fair and uniform across the country. Americans, we love to bash health insurers, but it also turns out when we, you know, if in advocating for Medicare for All, you ask people, are you support it? And then you tell them, oh, by the way, you won't have your private insurer anymore. Suddenly people are less enamored of it. We have a very conflicted, complicated relationship with insurers. I think, though, the Dutch and the German model is one way of getting the best of both. One of the great advantages of that kind of model is it actually could substantially reduce the excessive administrative costs we have in this country. One of the biggest things that differentiates us from every other country is just huge administrative costs. Hospitals billing different insurers, hospitals billing Medicare, the complexity of the different policies, the different payment rates, the different coverages. So we could simplify all of that if we adopted something like the Dutch or German system, and that would save a lot on the administrative side of healthcare costs. Let me mention one other item that I learned about as I traveled these countries that has particularly bothered me, and I think we could make an important reform about it. My father was a pediatrician. Providing healthcare to kids was something that was akin to mother's milk in our house. And my father often provided free care. He had a rule in his practice: the first three you paid for, if you could afford it. He often provided free care to people who couldn't afford it. The fourth and beyond, if you had four or more kids, they were free. One of the things I learned about in going around to different countries is that the United States is singularly unique in the private insurance market, for which covers most Americans, that we make families pay the full cost of insuring children. So I mentioned Germany and the Netherlands. In those countries, it turns out that the government pays for the health insurance of kids. So a worker who's an individual and a worker who's got a family, when they pay the payroll tax or when their employer pays the payroll tax, it's the same whether the employee has a family or is single. And then the government, if you have a family, pays the insurance company for the children and actually the non-working spouses in Germany. That means that the family is not responsible for paying for the premium, co-pays, deductibles for the children. In the United States, the financial burden on families is enormous when they have children for their health insurance. Let me just give you some numbers here. I don't want your eyes to glaze over at this hour. But roundabout for an individual, private health insurance through an employer is around $7,000. And coming out of the employee's paycheck is about $1,200 for that insurance. A family coverage, however, is almost three times that, at about $20,000, and the employee paying out of their paycheck pays over $6,000 for that family coverage, five times as much as the individual. Having kids, just the health insurance part, is super expensive. That $6,000, I will remind you, is 10% of the median income of a household in the United States. It's an enormous amount of money. We should do what the Dutch, the Germans, and frankly, every other country does in the world. The government, in other words, the whole of society, pays for the health care for children. We don't leave it up to individual families. We say, children, they're an investment of society, and we're going to pay for all of them to get the same high-quality health care. In the United States, we still have millions of children, about 4 million children, who don't have health insurance. I think that is outrageous. We should do something closer to the German or Dutch system and make sure all kids get coverage, and all kids get coverage paid for by the government, not by their families. There are many other lessons I could tell you about, from how to regulate drug prices to other things, from my fascinating study of these 11 different countries. But I'm sure you are itching to ask questions, and I'm more than eager to help and answer your questions. So thank you very much for listening patiently, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you for all of that. You were talking a few minutes ago, and it was one of the questions I had. You know, for those of you who haven't bought the book yet, there's an introduction, and it goes, you know, country by country, examining different things. And I found the history super fascinating. But one thing that I was thinking about, and you touched upon it a few minutes ago, how we feel about our healthcare and our insurers. Maybe just talking generally, or a few specific examples. How did people in these other countries feel about their healthcare systems? Did they feel better than we did about them?
So one of the things you learn is, first of all, when you're an American going to countries, they're very chauvinistic about their healthcare system, right? If Canadians talking to an American, we've got the best system. A Brit's talking to an American, the NHS. You go to Norway and, you know, they love, yes, our system's much better than yours. Right. Once you sit around for a while, you spend a few weeks there and you talk to them, what you find out is they complain plenty about their own healthcare system also. And you get all sorts of complaints. And so, yes, there is, when talking to foreigners, they'll defend their healthcare system, but then you can find out. So there's a lot of complaints, for example, in Norway about their waiting times. The waiting times have gotten better, but they really don't like their waiting times, and they do have some. You go to Switzerland, and everyone loves the Swiss healthcare system, except they complain strenuously. It's costing way too much, and it's very excessive payment. So you can get complaints from everybody about their own healthcare system, and they have different complaints depending upon the different system. For example, foreigners who live in the Netherlands and get healthcare in the Netherlands bitterly complain about the Dutch system, because the Dutch are very, you know, the Dutch primary care doctors are scrupulous about not over-treating. And so a lot of people who go to the Netherlands, they go to the doctor with a sore throat, they expect to get an antibiotic. And the Dutch are like, no, go home, it'll go away, it'll get better. And they complain that they never get treatment in the Netherlands. So you've got different approaches. And one of the things I took away from is no one's satisfied by their own healthcare system.
That makes me feel vaguely better that other
countries. I could also say that it's probably the worst of it is in China. All right. And let me say that the distrust of the healthcare system is sky high in China. Lots of patients and lots of families actually bribe doctors. They give them what's called red envelopes before a surgical procedure, thinking that they'll get better surgery if they give them money. And there's been a number of actual attacks and even killings of doctors when patients are dissatisfied or think they haven't gotten optimal care in China. So the distrust level is very, very high in China. Now, whatever the complaints people have in other places, they're not going around killing their doctors.
Well, that actually kind of segues into the other question I have, and then we'll hop into other people's. I always read the acknowledgments, and I'm always interested in the structural ways that nonfiction books are compiled. But it really leads in, I think, to this topic in an important way. You know, you talk about you and your team and, you know, people that helped you and other, you know, going to these places and doing, you know, primary source research. And did you find that certain countries were more eager, you know, to show you what they were doing, how they were innovating, did you find pushback in other countries? I mean, what was the level of, I mean, was access difficult in these things?
No.
Can that itself say something? Okay.
So, and this, I think, gets to the heart of maybe the value of the book, if I can be so immodest. When I started this book, I think, wow, we'll go to these countries, we'll learn what we can do and what we can bring back to the United States and different innovations that we might be able to adopt for the United States. And then, you know, the very first country I went to was Norway. And I asked all sorts of people in Norway, so tell me about how you got to this law and the structure of the healthcare system. And I got a lot of, I'm not sure. They said, you know, more or less, they didn't say it this way, but when you find out, would you tell us? And then, you know, I got several professors of health policy and professors in medical schools and said, you know, our students don't understand how the Norwegian healthcare system works. They're going to go in and be doctors, but they actually don't understand how the system, how the money flows, how we've decided what gets covered, what doesn't get covered, how drugs get paid for. And, you know, the only summary they have is this very big thing that comes out of the European Observatory, which is, you know, 250 pages or something. No student reads that in medical school. So they thought, you know, if I published a 10-page summary of Norway, it would be great. The medical students could read it and the nursing students and students in the healthcare system could read it. Similarly, I went to Germany a year later and talked to the officials at the equivalent of the German Medical Association for doctors and the German Hospital Association. And they really wanted this book because every time they go in and try to educate the German legislature, they're coming up with a new plan. They heard about some innovation in Norway. They want to bring it to Germany. They said, you know, trying to explain to them the difference between the German system, the Norwegian system, and why that innovation might not be adapted to a German system that has, you know, 100 private sickness funds, but Norway doesn't. Norway pays hospitals directly in municipalities that then pay doctors, you know, they said, well, having a book that actually, you know, summarizes these different countries and these different approaches would actually help us educate different parts of the community. So it turned out, I think, that this was just as interesting to people in other countries. They'd like to learn about, you know, the various countries we were going to. And as I mentioned in my talk, you know, when we talked about innovations in payment from the United States, they were like, other, you know, officials in other countries were fascinated about what we were doing. So one of the things I'm hoping is that this actually will be useful, not just for the United States, but for other countries. And in that regard, as you mentioned, there's a very long list of all the people we ended up talking to in other countries that really helped us out. And we could not have done it without the hospitality, the tireless work of these other collaborators. And I can tell you, I would be sending emails back and forth. I don't think I quite understand how you regulate the drug prices. Can you explain it to me just one more time? You know, and I'm sure, you know, the different people interpreted things differently. And I'm sure I've got some things wrong in the book. But that's because different people had slightly different perspectives on how the system actually worked.
Right. Okay, let's hop into some audience questions here. This one was the highest voted, and I will give one more spoiler and say there is a coda at the end of this book that starts to address some of these things. So people wanted to know the answer to this. This is from Stan, and he asked, how has the COVID pandemic exposed and damaged the primary care infrastructure of the U.S.?
Oh, that is a very, very good question. So let me just say, spoiler alert, I wrote a coda and we wrapped up the book. I sent it off to the publisher. We did copy editing and then COVID hit. And so early March, the editor who I work with at Public Affairs ripped out the coda and said, all right, you got to write a coda that deals with COVID and what lessons we might learn. Of course, it's going to be early. And by the time the book comes out in June, you know, it'll be 3 or 4 months old. And then once it sits on shelves, it'll be even older. But I think the audience is going to want to hear this. And boy, was he prescient and smart. So in the United States, you know, primary care practices have had to close. Revenues have gone down, even though they've gone online. And lots, you know, by some surveys, almost half of all primary care doctors fear they might have to shut their practices because of finances. And that would be a disaster. I am actually working with a number of insurers trying to figure out how we can both pay primary care doctors to keep them in business, but also shift their payment, do what I call, you know, that payment, so that they would actually not be paid fee for service, but be paid a lump sum capitation to take care of patients and thereby actually want to keep patients healthy and really focus on sicker patients. That's the sort of threat to primary care. The good thing is, as one commentator said, we've gone through a decade of telemedicine evolution in 4 months. And it's quite clear to everyone in the system how much more we can do via telemedicine and integrate it. It's useful for things like the worried well, you know, where you've got something, you want to check in with your doctor, but you don't want to go down. That will allow the doctor to do that and do it efficiently. On the other hand, for people with chronic illness or multiple chronic illnesses where more time might be necessary, both to figure out what's going on or to educate them about medications or to take care of their mental health that might come mental health issues that might come along with chronic illness, they can take more time and do it in person. That's the situation we want to get to. Whether we can get over this hump of financial instability and get to that better system, I think, you know, the jury's still out, but I think that could be a huge bonus for the American healthcare system, refocusing on primary care, using more telemedicine, and using the office visits more wisely. I have been a big advocate, as some people who follow me know, of, you know, shifting a lot more care out of hospitals, out of physician's offices to home. And I think that COVID could be the catalyst that makes that much, much more common. We'll have to see over the next few months, but I can assure the audience I'm doing my darndest to make that a reality in this country.
Cool. Thank you, Stan. This is from Stephanie. Since chronic diseases constitute the major reason healthcare costs are so high, and since many of these diseases are arguably preventable, i.e. not smoking, healthier diets, regular exercise, et cetera, do you think an equivalent focus on prevention as well as on disease management go a long way toward allaying our healthcare problems? And are there any countries that are seriously focusing on prevention? I'm presuming she means so we can emulate slash rip them off.
Well, that's a big question, but you're right. If you look at health outcomes, longevity and other things, there are healthcare, the actual services you get from a doctor or the surgical procedures contributes a small amount. Four things contribute a big amount. You mentioned them. First, good nutrition, not eating processed food, staying away from the sugar, staying away from empty calories. Very important. Really contributes to longevity. Eating your vegetables. I'm a big proponent of yogurt because it comes out high on those lists. I'm a big cynic about potatoes because it comes out high on the list of things you shouldn't eat. But diet, exercise, absolutely, you're 100% right. Exercise is critical. We know that it's got all sorts of benefits cardiovascularly. It helps rearrange the brain and the neurons. We know that it changes how you metabolize. It may not make you lose weight. It's hard to exercise sufficiently to lose weight, but it has a lot of other advantages that also does keep your weight stable. Not smoking. Smoking is horrible for you. There is no positive that comes out of smoking. Maybe there's some mental health stress for some people, but there are other ways of dealing with that problem. Smoking causes lung cancer and lots of other cancers, bladder problems, throat problems, emphysema, you name it. Heart disease. It's a really bad thing. Not smoking is important. Now, the United States, for a long time, we were leaders in getting people to quit smoking. Over the last 50 years, we've really brought it down from adults in the high 40% were smokers. We're now down into the teens. But the last time the cigarette tax went up was 2009 under President Obama. We really need to increase the tax. We know that if you increase the price of smoking, most teenagers and young adults will not smoke. They are very price sensitive. And if you don't smoke by the time you're 25, you're really never going to smoke. It's a rare bird who picks it up at 30 or 40. And so we've got to, I think, do more on the smoking side of the world. There are countries that have now overtaken us in terms of getting rid of smoke or dissuading people from smoking. Australia is at the top of that list. They've really pushed it hard, and we could learn a lot from Australia in that regard. And the last thing is avoiding accidents and problems like that, wearing your seatbelt. Other accidents around the house, a big set of accidents for children relate to swimming, drowning in the baths, drowning while swimming. So there are a number of things we could do: better diet, exercise, not smoking, seatbelts, and avoiding accidents that are pretty predictable. That is, you're right. That is going to add more years to our life than the healthcare system.
I'm seeing two or three people have this question, and I certainly had this question. Why are drugs so much cheaper in so many other countries than the U.S.? You teased us about ways to reduce drug costs. What is your rate? So let's talk about drugs. How do we as citizens, and how institutionally do we tackle that?
Really good question. So first of all, if you're really committed to low drug prices, Norway, Taiwan, Australia, high up on your list. The United States has the world's highest drug costs. I think I say in the book, and if I don't, I'm telling you here now, We have about just under 4.5% of the world's population lives in the United States, 330 million people out of 7.8 billion people in the world. On the other hand, our expenditures for drugs are about between 40 and 45% of all the world's drug spending occurs just in the United States. So we are way out of the ballpark when it comes to drugs. Every other country we looked at regulates drug prices. We do not. We are unique. We give drug companies patent protection, marketing protection from the FDA for drugs. And then we say, you've got a monopoly, go ahead and price it. What do people who have a monopoly do when they're given pricing power? They send the price through the roof. So it's no surprise we have high drug prices. One of the reasons we regulate electricity, gas, is that those producers have monopolies and we don't want them to, you know, just drive the price sky high. Same thing with drugs. Every other country has some mechanism for regulating drugs. We go through the whole list of what different countries do and how they're do it better. Let me just say a few things. I think in the end, I've got eight different lessons that we can learn from other countries. But here's one. Almost every country uses objective measures of drugs and drug benefit and drug prices to set their drug price. So, for example, they link the price of a drug to the health benefit of a drug. You don't just say, oh, you put a drug on the market and you're going to price it sky high, even though it might prolong life for 2 months or, you know, avoid baldness. You have to relate the health benefit to the price you can charge. The bigger the health benefit, the more you can charge. So that's an objective measure. A lot of countries look at what other countries are charging. Norway does this. They look at a basket of other countries and they say the price in Norway, it's going to be an average of the lowest three prices for other drugs. Countries also say, look, if you've got a drug in one category, it's special. You can have a premium. But when the second drug in that category, so for example, the second statin to treat cholesterol comes on the market, we're lowering your price. Other countries have another mechanism and they say, you know, every few years we're going to re-examine the price and lower it. And they have built in time periods where they actually lower the price of drug. The longer it's on the market, the lower the drug price is. And so they, you know, if you're on the market for 3 years in Switzerland, then the price, they re-examine it and often they just bring the price down. If you're making too much profit, they'll bring the price of the drug down. So there are a lot of mechanisms by which you can do drug pricing. I will just mention finally that a lot of countries have a basket of how much they're going to spend on drugs and they're purchased centrally by the government. And if the basket of prices goes up or you have to add more drugs, they actually need a legislative act to get the price, that drug to be sold in the country so that they need either approval by the cabinet or approval by the whole parliament for a very expensive drug. So these are various mechanisms of trying to keep drug prices down. I think the most intuitive one and the one we should adopt is the price has got to correlate with how much health benefit we're getting from the drug. That just seems so logical. The higher the quality, great, we're willing to pay for it. If it's not doing very much in terms of promoting health, that's not a top priority or not something we should spend a lot of money on. I will say I then, in an article, not in the book, I actually look at these different procedures in other countries and then try to look at the legislation that's being proposed in the United States. I don't want to be insulting, but the legislation in the United States goes nowhere near even the country with the minimal requirements in the rest of the world. Our legislation is very weak compared to the drug price regulation in every other part of the world.
I don't know if it's beyond the purview of the book, but there's an interesting question here that I think would be. So it says, can we address the inequities in our healthcare system without first addressing the inequities in our social structures?
That is a
tiny question. Yeah, it's a big question.
That's a very good question. And let me say, I think we have to do them both simultaneously. One of the things you do learn by going to other countries is that some of the inequities we have here are reproduced in other countries that have single payer, that have other even more equal social safety nets. They're based upon, you know, education, they're based upon socioeconomic status of the people, and they're also often based upon race, even in those countries. But I do agree with you. You know, if you can't address all the health disparities that we're seeing, exacerbated by COVID, highlighted by COVID, just by addressing the improving the healthcare system, you have to address underlying problems. And again, as we mentioned, underlying problems contribute to health. You want to fix some of the disparities? Let's fix the education system. You want to fix some of the disparities? Let's fix the housing system. We've got to fix the food distribution system in this country and make healthy food more affordable. So there's, I agree with the presumption or the assumption or the claim of this question that you want to fix the disparities in our healthcare system, racial, socioeconomic, and otherwise. You have to address more than the healthcare system itself. You have to address the underlying social structures. And let me tell you a secret, which to those people who follow me in the health policy world know, one of the reasons I'm obsessed and one of the reasons I did this book is I want to bring down the cost that we're of American healthcare. So we're spending 18%, the next highest country is in the 12s. And one of the reasons is there's a lot of money there that we could spend on remedying these other problems that we've just identified. If we brought down how much we spend on healthcare by 6% of the GDP, 6% of the GDP is over $1 trillion. Just imagine all the social problems we could solve, right? Housing would be better. Infrastructure would be better. We could invest in education. We could invest in early childhood intervention. That's why I'm obsessed by trying to fix the healthcare system, because I think there's a lot of money there that can help these social problems a lot.
Sort of on that same note too, someone asked, and I think a lot of us wonder about this watching the news, who or is there an adult in the room? The question is anyone or governmental authority overseeing moving valuable resources such as ventilators to the some 22 states currently experiencing significant increases in active COVID cases, or is it still each governor or healthcare system for themselves? Like, is there a top-down structure here? Are we just going in a, you know, every man, woman, and child for him, her, themselves?
I don't think we're quite there, but it is the case that Donald Trump has made it, and I don't want to make this a partisan thing, right, but Donald Trump has made it quite clear that the federal government is not responsible for the how to handle COVID. They've made it clear, the CDC hasn't issued a lot of guidance about how businesses are to open, how schools are to open. They've issued some, but it's hardly the kind of granular guidance that the CDC would have issued in years past. Similarly, coordinating supplies for PPE, making sure we have the manufacturers who can do it in the United States, getting them up and running. I'll tell you one of my chief concerns going forward is, say we get a vaccine. It turns out that one of the big bottlenecks for actually getting enough vaccine and getting it out is what's called fill and finish, actually putting the vaccine into glass tubes sterilely and sealing them up, packaging them and getting them out. It turns out that the factories that do this fill and finish, the product lines that do this, they're, and I didn't know this before I began working on this, they're 100 times more sterile than an operating room. I mean, they are as clean as you can get. And they take years to build. And the world capacity, not the US, the world's capacity for fill and finish is stretched very thin for vaccines, is stretched very thin, because they're running at 80, 85% capacity. And we don't have capacity to do, call it 7.8 billion doses for the whole world. So one thing that the government should be doing today, they should have been doing before, was to actually heavily investing money in getting a couple or three factories that can fill and finish these vaccines up and running. They take time to run, but this COVID thing isn't going away tomorrow. It's going to be here for several years at least, and we need excess capacity on the fill and finish just for vaccines. And if we end up having to give the COVID vaccine every year or every 2 years, we'll need that extra capacity. Federal government's not doing that. So I think your worry, the worry that's in that question, is very much true. I think Donald Trump would like to assert authority, but not have any responsibility for solving these problems. And the consequence is, you know, we have not had a good coordinated response, whether it's PPE or testing. And we won't, I think, end up with the, when it comes to the distribution of the vaccine.
There's another question here, and I kind of link it to this in some ways also. The question is, do you think that the Netherlands has been successful in part because of its smaller size, at least as compared to the U.S.? Because I was thinking about that in terms with New Zealand, you know, eliminating COVID. Well, it's a smaller island country, you know, with, you know, without our geographical, you know, sprawl and governmental, you know, boondoggles. So do you have to be fair to them, to us, I suppose, in that regard?
Fair question, but I also think not quite on target. It is true that solving a lot of problems and complications is easier in smaller countries. It also happens to be true it's easier in countries that have higher levels of trust of their government and actually think government is a force for good in the countries. It is the case that Norway is the smallest country we went to with around about 5 million people. But I think that criticism also misses the mark in the following sense. First of all, we were trying to learn something about how you can design systems. Now, Norway, I would have thought that the chief advantage was Norway was not its size, but the chief advantage of Norway is its density. Everyone lives just a few miles, I think it's 15 minutes or 25 minutes, except for a couple of islands in the North Sea. They live something like 15 or 25 minutes from the nearest hospital. I forget the exact number. So they have advantages of density that we don't have because we, you know, 20% of our population is rural, like Canada, like Australia, like Norway. But the Dutch, that's a big advantage they have. But let me remind you, we went to Germany. Germany is over 80 million people. It's a very large country. And they have a system that, you know, it has its problems. And I mentioned one of them, too many hospital beds. Their system works, you know, much lower cost completely. They have much better choice of insurance companies, doctors, and hospitals than Americans do. And they have lower copays at the point of care, free copays for when you go to see a doctor. I think a lot of Americans, if we could import that system, which we can't, lift and shift, you'd be really happy. You can choose your insurance company. You can choose any doctor in the country, any hospital in the country. You would actually like it a lot. So I don't think it's just the size of the populations. I do think I've done one, you know, big, big country. I've done countries with other rural populations. We have a big structural problem here, set of structural problems that we need to solve.
I got time for two more quick ones here.
I'll do my best to be disciplined.
Okay. The last one you're going to love. So the penultimate, do other countries have for-profit components within the main healthcare delivery systems, hospitals, surgical clinics, et cetera? And is there any evidence they provide any benefit, actual benefit to the systems as a whole?
So it is funny you should ask that question. Yes, there are components of for-profit in other systems. And sometimes it's, you know, there's no word but sort of cockamamie for it. So take Switzerland. By law, every health insurance company needs to be private. But they can be not-for-profit, but they can be a not-for-profit arm of a for-profit company that sells supplemental insurance to people in the healthcare insurance space. And this arrangement is shrouded in mystery in Switzerland. So there's a for-profit component. There are for-profit hospitals in other countries. There are and there are private components that often take up the state system contracts with them. In Australia, for example, a lot of the elective surgery is done through private insurance because the surgeons can make more money that way. And so they slow up the amount of surgeries they do in the state system and funnel them to the private system where their fees are higher. Let me say, we can argue this all we want. First of all, let me remind you that a lot of the insurers in the United States, especially the Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans, Kaiser, they're not for profit. There are big for profit, United, Humana, Aetna, Cigna, but they're also not-for-profit insurers. They're not-for-profit hospitals. They're for-profit hospitals. In the 1990s, that was a big issue, the for-profit hospitals and not-for-profit hospitals. Lots of people, I think, as your question suggests, were suspicious about for-profit hospitals. I think the sum total of that research, it's fair to say, and a lot of it, the best of it, was done by a professor who was out at Berkeley, Steve Shortell. He, for a period of time, was the dean of the School of Public Health at Berkeley, showed you couldn't find a real difference between the for-profit, not-for-profit hospitals, at least in the United States. And part of that is the not-for-profit hospitals are trying to make a margin too. The for-profit hospitals actually might improve efficiency. And, you know, Lord knows, not-for-profit hospitals have a lot of inefficiency. So I think the main of the result, certainly on the hospital side, is doesn't make a big, that's not the key differential between for-profit for-profit, not-for-profit hospitals in terms of quality output necessarily. So I think that's not, you know, if I were to try to reform the American healthcare system, that's not the first place I would look.
Okay, and we're at time, so I have one more quick one for you here, and it's a great question. And why not have a good softball? Though I would have trouble doing this. I would have trouble choosing. The question asker writes, I noticed the books about the Apollo program on your shelf. Who are your top three astronauts?
You want the honest truth here?
Let's see.
The honest truth? My partner is the curator of the Air and Space Apollo exhibit at Air and Space. That's why we have all these Air and Space books. You would have to ask her. I can give you my top two. My top two are the Apollo 11, Mike Collins, who I've had the good fortune of meeting through my partner and is at, I think he's 89 or 90, brilliant, still has a great sense of humor, still in amazing mental and physical shape, and just his sense of humor is incredible. And you have to give Neil Armstrong just an all-around, absolutely amazing guy, modest. He never tried to exploit his position of being the first man on the moon to make a ton of money. He had an unbelievably prescient quote that everyone knows when he took that step, which he made up himself. And he was a man who, you know, nothing flapped him. He did his job. He was very duty bound. You might also think of Frank Borman. There are a lot of stories. He was the commander of the Apollo 8, the first mission that went circled the moon. And he was a man who was duty bound. Everything was national duty. And that's an admirable virtue. You know, I didn't agree with his politics, and there's lots of things, but he was a guy who took national duty extremely seriously. And I think that's a unbelievably important virtue, and I greatly admire it. You know, you're asking an ignoramus about
I think those are excellent answers,
but that's the best I could do.
And it's a great dovetail talking about national duty and all what we should all be doing during these uncertain times. So thank you, Zeke, for joining us tonight. Great conversation. And thank you, everyone, for your great questions. To our viewers at home, be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author-events to access our digital archives and our updated event schedule. So thanks again. Keep reading. Take care of each other. Have a great night. Thank you, Zeke, very much.
Thank you. Great to be with you. And thanks for those terrific questions. They really were some of the best I've ever gotten.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.